Good evening, everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes, in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on abluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Our speaker tonight, John S., I think he was at the very beginning of the Fifth Tradition group. Very strong group. You'll see why. Please welcome John S.
Hey, everybody. I'm John Shires. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to use this. It's just good form in A to carry a big book up. Makes you, gives you gravitas. thank you, Tim, for that really nice introduction. My sobriety date is March 7th, 1989, and I don't say that to impress you, but it impresses the ever-loving dog crap out of me. It's a funny thing, you stick around, you stay sober long enough, and people start asking you to tell your story, and then they give you nice introductions and stuff like that. And it's really funny to me, knowing who I was, and you'll hear some of that tonight when I got here. I didn't get introductions. I didn't get asked to come places. I got asked to leave places. I got asked to shut up. I got, I didn't have very many friends. Matter of fact, I don't think I had a single friend when I got sober 30 years ago in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't even think I was an alcoholic. I had to come here to learn that fact. I caught that illness from you guys by sitting in your meetings and listening to this deal. I want to just read a little something actually here. This is actually on the title page of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is pointed out to me by a man who's dead now. That Alcoholics Anonymous is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. It's a story. And we are a storytelling society. And whether it's standing at a podium and just telling you my whole story or some version of it or some condensed version of it, because the longer you stay sober, the more crap happens to you, the less you can tell. But whether I'm telling it from a podium or whether I'm open in an open discussion meeting, I'm raising my hand and sharing. What we do is we share our experience, strength, and hope. We tell our stories, you know. And so the good news, especially for my newer members, my newer friends who are here and haven't been sober very long, is if you think I suck or that I'm full of hot air, I'm trying not to curse. there'll be another speaker next Monday. So that's the good news. So if you don't like any of this, don't you worry. There's going to be plenty more to come from somebody else down the road. I told you my sobriety date. My home group is a Fifth Tradition group. It's a big book study on Thursday nights, 8 p.m., and a speaker meeting on Saturday nights, 7 p.m. And it's a wonderful group. It's a Three Legacies group of Alcoholics Anonymous, Unity, Service, and Recovery. And that's the kind of home group that I need to be in. And I think my home group is the best group on the planet. And I was told early on, if you don't think that about your home group, then change home groups or help your home group to get stronger and better. And I really feel that way. But the home group for me is a very central part of my recovery. So that's the reason I tell you that. And the third thing I want to tell you is I have a sponsor. My sponsor is a man named Jerry Elkins. He's been my sponsor for 21 years. And I love that man to death. He has helped me and carried me through some things. And it's important to have a sponsor. And it's equally important to have a sponsor who knows that he is your sponsor. Because I, for a couple of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a series of sponsors that didn't know they were my sponsor. And they really couldn't help me very much, not knowing that they were sponsoring me. I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and a salesman. I got this alcoholic ability that I can walk into a room, size it up in about 8 seconds, and kind of start giving people what I think they need or what they think they want personality-wise. You know, the way I behave, the way I act, the way I walk, you know, the kind of music that I'm going to claim to like, the kind of, you know, the path. I mean, my whole story is very malleable. You know what I'm saying? It's very fluid. You know what I'm saying? I got lies for every occasion. And that's how I've always been. I mean, I was like that 5, 6 years old. You know, 5 years old, my old man caught me. At 5 years old, I was already a big shot. At 5 years old, I was already stealing money out of my dad's coin jar, going down to the 7-Eleven with my friends and buying them kites and cap guns and candy bars. And, you know, it was like I was a big spender. I was already buying friends at 5 years old. I don't know where that came from. I personally, I think I was born an alcoholic, just instant alcoholic, just add liquor, you know. But I had my hand in this big old beer stein that all my dad's change went into. And he came in the room and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm counting it." Just like that. The lie just was there. It was ready. It was ready to go. You know, so I come in here and I start doing that. I carried that into Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm telling y'all. I carried this, you know, this BS, this phoniness, this image, this street thing, this front. It's funny to me, too, how many alcoholics end up in sales. We are the best damn salespeople ever. Alcoholics can sell. And they just, once they get their rap down about whatever it is they're selling, you know, that's why so many alcoholics end up in selling drugs, you know. There's a whole, that satisfies about 19 different needs for the alcoholic right there, you know. But anyway, I'll tell you my story, which is basically going to be what it used to be like, you know, what I was like when I got here, what happened since I got here, and what my life is like today. So I grew up, I actually come from a good family. It's kind of a crazy family. I got 7 brothers and sisters. About half of us are alcoholics. My old man was not an alcoholic. He's what the big book would call a hard drinker. Someone who drinks really hard, but never went to jail, never got a DUI, never lost a job, was very successful in his life. In business-wise, relationship-wise, he was married and divorced 4 times, and he's divorced at 87 years old now. But I have 7 brothers and sisters, including half-brothers and sisters. There's quite a few step-brothers and sisters mixed in there for different amounts of time. And it's just a lot of fun, you know, a lot of alcoholism, a lot of craziness. And I grew up in South Tampa, a nice neighborhood, went to nice schools. The truth of it is I was given everything that a person ought to need to be happy, joyous, and free in this life. And I was not happy, joyous, and free in this life. And from the youngest age that I can remember, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, to use the language from our big book. I was not happy. I was not comfortable in my own skin. I always was comparing myself to others and either coming up short or coming up way better. But either way, it didn't make me feel any, you know, better. If I felt like I was better than you, then there was still this distance between me and you. And mostly I felt like I wasn't measuring up, you know, and I didn't have what it takes. So everyone, like, you know, you hear a lot of alcoholics say this. Like, everybody else had the playbook to life, and I didn't have the playbook to life. You know, I can remember being 5, 6, 7 years old on the playground at school, watching all the other kids run around and thinking, everyone's just doing that so easy. Everyone's just got this thing. They're just able to just participate in things, and I overthink everything. And I remember thinking, I wonder if they think like I think. You know, I wonder if they're sitting there ever having these thoughts about how do you connect with people and how do you get right with other folks. And tell them I'll call them back. Like I said, I come from a big alcoholic family, but it was a very loving family. You know, my mother was as loving. I mean, my mom had a shit childhood. My mom had a crap childhood. And, I mean, she had all kinds of abuse and just, you know, just a crazy background. And she was bound to determine that her boys, myself and my 2 younger brothers, were going to have better than what she had. And she went about that, but she came into some money. And she did pretty well for herself. And then we had a nice house, and we had toys, and we had stuff, and my mom was real out there, like a real artsy woman, you know, really a progressive type. And she built a fire pole, or had a fire pole built in our home. Like, have you ever known any kids that had a fire? That's how I got downstairs every morning, because my mom was so cool and out there. She had this fire pole, and me and my brothers would come tearing down the hall and jump out and land on this, zoop, down to the kitchen, man, go get your breakfast. And when that sucker was first installed, we had every kid in the neighborhood in that house running down the hall, up the stairs, onto the fire pole, down to the kitchen, down the hall, up the stairs. It was maniacal. And the energy level in my house was like that. Our house was the house that all the kids came to, because my mom was real paranoid that some bad stuff would happen to us and other people's homes, because that's the kind of background she came out of, you know. So all the kids were at our house. All the fun was at my house. We had a big skateboard ramp built in the backyard. I mean, I'm talking full-on half-pipe, you know, for any of you skate rats, ex-skate rats in here. You know, I mean, 40 feet long, 16 foot wide, 10 foot high, vert, channel, you know, the whole thing, man. And we skated and we... you know, and I played sports, and I played football, and I played baseball, and I was into things. But I never fit anywhere. You know what I'm saying? I didn't fit. I went to church. I didn't fit at church. I went to this really nice school, private school. Didn't fit there. I skateboarded, but I didn't fit with the skate rats. You know, and I played sports, but I didn't fit with the jocks. And I just didn't fit anywhere. And I was just a kid who was tense. I probably could not have put any of that into words at the time. This is all with the benefit of hindsight, of looking back at my life. I'm able, after coming into AA and working this 12 steps, I could see things about myself clearly today that I could not see when I got here. I just knew I was unhappy. Okay, and the first time that I got not unhappy anymore was the first time I got drunk. And I was 13 years old, and I went out with some older boys in the neighborhood. I remember I was really excited that I was included with these several older kids, you know, and also incredibly nervous, like I was going to make a fool of myself around these old cool kids, you know what I'm saying? And I'm 13, and they're like 14, 15, 16, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, I don't know if y'all can remember back. If you were 13 and you get to hang out with a 16-year-old in the neighborhood, one of the cool kids, like the pressure, the power of that, it meant something, you know, and I was terrified I was going to blow it and not be cool enough. But we went out, the four of us, and we got 8 quarts of Mickey's Mean Green Malt Liquor. And by the time I got through half a quart, this was not my first drink, but this was my first drunk. Because like I said, I'd had sips off my old man's beer, and, you know, my parents entertained a lot, and I could have a sip of wine at Christmas and stuff like, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. First drunk, half a quart of Mickey's. By the time the half a quart was in, I was transformed into a different person. And I was funnier and faster talking and taller and skinnier and cooler. And I was the life of the party. It was just like instant, like, new guy, transformation. You know, somebody has made this comparison. I'm going to, let's see if I dig this out real quick. I think, isn't it 83 the promises are on? No, it's 84. how the promises that we get after we work the ninth step are like what alcohol does for us. You know, and so... We will be amazed before we're halfway through. I was amazed before I was halfway through that first quart of malt liquor. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. That is what I knew. You know, we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door. I didn't care. I will comprehend the word serenity and know peace. Then that is exactly what happened to me. That is what alcohol did for me. And that night ended badly. And this is going to be a pattern, okay? That night ended badly. It ended up with me sick. It ended up with me throwing up. It ended up with me in a movie theater. I guess this is about 1984. So whatever Eddie Murphy movie was going on in 1984, 48 Hours maybe, one of them movies. Anyway, we're seeing this Eddie Murphy movie, and I'm just drunk as a skunk in the theater, laughing my ass off. And I just thought it would be cool to piss in the theater. And my last memory before I blacked out was leaning back like this in a seat and an arc of urine going over the seat in front. And there was nobody in the seat, but it was loud enough and visible enough what was going on. And my friends were all just cracking up. They thought that was the funniest thing ever until we all got chased out of the joint and ended up having to make a hasty exit. And I got home to my friend's house where I was spending the night that night and I got sick all over his parents' place and got... You know, I mean, everybody got in trouble because of me. So now, I'm instantaneously first night drunk. I'm the jerk off who cannot hold his liquor and gets everybody in trouble. All the parents of all the kids involved all got called, and you know, and everyone was in trouble, and everyone was grounded or whatever on restriction. I don't know, 13 years old, like what happens? My Atari was taken away. That's how old I am. You know, all that stuff. You know, and but so a lot of trouble. I was very sick the next day. But the take home, the thing that happened to me that night was then and the next day going forward was that was the greatest night of my life. That was the feeling that I took away from that. Greatest night of my life. Can't wait to do this again. When are we going to do this again? And like the next weekend, we did it again. You know, I mean, I'm 13 years old, and again, I have a pretty strict mother actually, in terms of like. You had to go to church, and you had to be home for dinner, and, you know, all these kind of things. And she was a single mom raising 3 wild and crazy boys, and so those were the few rules that she had. So I wasn't drinking every day at 13 years old, but I wanted to. I wanted to. And anyway, it escalated as much as we could escalate it. You know, turns out we lived in a neighborhood where there were a lot of potential alcoholics among my friends in the neighborhood. And there were a lot of parents, like my parents, who had big liquor cabinets and entertained and stuff and had might have 8-10 bottles or 12 bottles of different liquor. And so we did the thing that you do where, you know, you take 2 inches off this bottle and 2 inches off that bottle, and so, and you mix them in a jar. Yeah, you got vodka and gin and vermouth and, you know, creme de menthe and, you know, scotch and bourbon and, you know, just whatever. And just this concoction that's slightly cloudy and just of indeterminate color. And you know, take it off in the woods and, you know, 3 or 4 guys, and, you know, you pass it around and you take a big hit off this jar, and, you know, you pass it to the next guy. It just keeps going around. Every time you hit it, you go, man, that's really smooth. You know, like, try to be cool about it, you know, and it was awful. It was like, hold your, you know. And but that's what we did, and I drank every chance I got. You know, a few years later, you know, started smoking weed, popping pills, doing whatever. I'm that kind of alcoholic. And I'm the type of alcoholic, I should not do drugs. Because I do drugs like an alcoholic does drugs, alcoholically. I should stay away from drugs at all costs, but I did not. And I mixed all that stuff, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it in any detail, but I'm the kind of guy who, you know, people would look at me and say, what does it feel like to be somebody who would do anything? You know? I mean, and that was my life. I would do anything. So anyway, that kind of progressed through high school. In the 9th grade, I was going to a pretty nice local high school, a college prep school. I was, you know, my folks were professional. My old man was a doctor. He was a self-made man. And my mom was a nurse. And it was expected in our family that you should get an education. They put a lot of stock on that. I was raised to respect, like, getting an education or getting some kind of a real job in life and all this kind of stuff. Of course, I blew that all to hell. But I went to good schools, and I got into the really good high school, the good private high school where all the kids went to college and all the kids were involved in extracurricular activities, and they all had resumes of all the stuff they did outside of school, and they all played athletics and blah, 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 blah. And I show up there, like, you know, I have long hair now. I'm in, like, the 9th grade. I'm like a rebel. The quintessential rebel without a clue. And I lasted at that nice school for about 4 or 5 months before me and a bunch of the other guys that I had. You know, it's funny how I can find the alcoholic anywhere. You know, I could find the people who party like I want to party. Like, that's another. I can walk into a room and be like, you know, okay, that guy's got a hookup, and, you know, and that chick's carrying, you know what I'm saying, and I guarantee you she wants to go in the bathroom and do some bumps, you know. Just like bing, 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 bing. Like, I just pick up on that stuff. And so I'm running with those kind of people almost immediately, and we all get in trouble one day. We all kind of went out for lunch and drank some beers and got high, and this one kid OD'd, you know, took too many pills. I don't know what he did, but he knocked on the rest of us. We all got kicked out of that school. We all made an example of. And so I ended up getting kicked out of that one school, going to another school. Which was the school that I really wanted to go to, was where all my degenerate friends went, to the public high school in South Tampa, Plant High School. If we got any Tampites in here. But anyway, and school was the place to go to hook up. School was the place to go to score. School was the place to go to meet up and get loaded. And I used to go to school early. Which initially, when that started, my folks were like, oh, John, he's turning over a new leaf. He's going to school early. You know, but I would go to school at 7. It started at like 7:30 or 8 to meet up with my friends, go down to the golf course, and we would drink before school. And then we would ditch at lunch, and we would go drink and party in, on this little wooded area on this golf course, like a little hangout. And so, I don't know, high school just kind of blurred by. And I wasn't doing terribly well. And in my second junior year, which might tell you something, I dropped out. Now, my old man, who I was living with at this time, is a Marine. He's an ex-Marine. I mean, hardcore. I mean, old school. Fought in Korea, man. You know, GI Bill. Went to college. Went to medical school. Became a doctor. Started a business. Started a company. Now it's got 600 employees. You know, and he's just an ass kicker. He just gets it done. He's a get her done type guy. And I don't know how he got cursed with a son like me, but that's, you know, cosmic karma there. But I dropped out of high school, and, you know, so now I'm 18 years old at this time. I got hair halfway down my back. I wear nothing but black mostly heavy metal t-shirts like Slayer, Metallica, Death Angel, you know. And I never really take care of my hair, so it's all, you know. I got a photograph. If anyone wants to see what I looked like when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a photograph that I carry on my phone because I never want to forget. But I had cool hair. But anyway, but my old man was like, he did one of the most helpful things he could ever have done. He kicked me out. He's like, there's no way this no long-haired hippie, alcoholic, junkie, scumbag son of mine is going to drop out of high school and just like live here, you know. So I was a tough guy. So I did what tough guys do, and I went home to live with my mother in her basement. And I kind of puttered around for about another year, year and a half before I ended up in treatment here in Atlanta, Georgia. I grew up in Tampa, and I ended up in Gainesville, Florida, which is not a good town for an up-and-coming alcoholic. It's a big-ass college party town. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a 24-hour party town. And I ended up about a year after I dropped out of high school, a year and a half maybe, in Gainesville, Florida, in the winter of 1988 going into 89. And I was living on the outskirts of town in this house, and the rent on this house was nothing. It was $450 a month for a three-bedroom fence yard. You know, this is the late 80s. I mean, and it's a little country town, really, once you get out that far. And we were getting evicted, my roommate and I. It was $450 a month, maybe another $150 a month for all the utilities. It's $600 a month, two guys, both working full-time, and can't pay the rent because every dollar that came into my pocket went right out of my pocket. You know, so I had pawned everything I owned. You know, I've always been a guitar player. I had a couple of nice guitars. One of those guitars was all I had left. I had one guitar and a little practice amp, and that sucker had been in and out of the pawn shop so many times, I guarantee you I'd paid for that guitar like five times over. Oh man, I'll get paid Friday, and it's Monday, so I can go pawn it, and then I'll have some money. You know, and it'll be all right, you know. So whatever, the bottom came with, so we were getting ready to be evicted, but before that happened, the water had gotten turned, all the utilities had gotten turned off, and, you know, kind of sequentially, and the last one to go was the water. Now, you could bullshit yourself into thinking it's romantic to live by candlelight once your power gets turned off, you know what I'm saying? You can kind of like, look, alcoholics are delusional, right? And I'm no exception. I'm delusional, and I'm self-centered, and I make up stories and I tell those stories to myself until I believe them. And so, but when the water gets turned off, it gets pretty bad. You can't shower, you can't brush your teeth. Okay, so the last couple of 2 months, I'm not showering, I'm not brushing my teeth, drinking all day, every day, getting loaded all day, every day. The house is just this pigsty. It's just the most disgusting, you know, there's nothing but alcoholics and, you know, and shady ass people in and out of this place. And it's just dirty, and it's just all kinds of empties and drug paraphernalia. It's just a whacked out scenario. And there's no water, but we're still using the toilet, you know? So you know what the house smelled like. You know, it smelled like that rest stop on Mount Zion Road on I-75 heading down to Florida. And our solution, and this is I would never, ever want to forget this, is at this time, so I was so smart. Okay, and by the way, I am a very smart person. Okay, I am, I got the letters behind my name today to prove it. I didn't have any of that shit at that time. But I'm a highly intelligent person, not a lot of common sense, highly delusional also. So, can't flush the toilet, but we're still using the toilet. What do? Well, you go steal water to flush your toilet. And the way you do that is you go into your neighbor's yard in the middle of the night, and you steal their garden hose, and you run it in your bathroom window, and you fill the tank up, and you give it a good flush. And maybe you fill up a bucket, or maybe you fill up a sink with water so there's a little bit of water for the morning or something like that. The thought that I had after coming up with that scheme was, you know, John, you're a real survivor, man. You know, a lot of guys just would not be able to deal with this situation. You're dealing with it, you know. You're like alcoholic MacGyver, you know. It's funny now, but that's where I was living. That's what my life looked like when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I bought into that line. Anyway, fast forward. Where's Tim? Where are you at, Tim? What time am I stopping at?
Ten till? 15,
okay, yeah. I just want to make sure I don't overtalk. So anyway, I come in. I end up in rehab. And I'm not an alcoholic. I am not a drug addict. I do not have a drug or alcohol problem, but I'm in rehab. in Atlanta. And I remember thinking going in there, I know I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I know that's not the problem. I know in my mind that the problem is the way I was before I started drinking. The problem is the way I was when I'm not drinking. When I'm completely bone dry sober, I know that that's an intolerable place. But I don't really have all the words to say all that. I just know that I if I could take care of my crazy, which I have, you know, then somehow that's going to translate into my life looks okay, and I'm comfortable in my own skin, and I can get by, and I can be all right. So that's the way I go into rehab. I get into rehab. We go to a lot of AA meetings. They bring in meetings, speaker meetings on the outside. People come in and tell their story just like I'm doing tonight. And I start hearing these stories. And again, we're a storytelling society. I'm a big believer in the speaker meeting. I'm a big believer in the talk. I love going to AA conferences like the Atlanta Roundup, some of the other small conferences, the big state conference, the Georgia Prepaid Convention happens every year. You hear these people, because they always get people who've been sober a long time and have, they've really been working the steps for a long time, and they have a lot of a message, a story to tell. But I kept hearing these stories, and these weren't people like that. These were people 6 months sober, a year sober, 2 years sober, 5 years sober, you know, and they would come in and tell their story. And I did what happens when a real alcoholic hears the story of another real alcoholic. I nodded along to the story. You know, oh yeah, I've done that. Oh yeah, I felt like that. I've done that. Oh no, don't nod your head. They're going to notice. They're going to think you're one of them. You know, just all this paranoid crap going on. You know, and but after, really, in a short period of time, like 30 days, and I was inpatient treatment. This is back in the late 80s, and I was 19 years old when I got sober. I was still in my folks' insurance, and back in the late 80s, insurance would pay and pay and pay, and I was inpatient for 4.5 months. At this treatment center, and so I must have got, I don't know, how many AA meetings, plus counseling and all the therapeutic stuff that they did. You know, I was just inundated, soaked into this thing. But after about 30 days, I was like, I'm an alcoholic. You know, and, you know, they had a little level system in the rehab, you know, and eventually you got high enough level, you get in the white van. Any white van people here? You know, go to the meetings in the white van. And so went all around Atlanta, all these meetings, and, you know, got out, did a halfway house, three-quarter house, 19-16th house. And all of the levels, that whole deal. And about a year sober, I got out of the system. And I got a sober roommate and got a place to live. And just threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous and loved it. And really loved it. And that was about the time that someone said, when I was in that rehab or halfway house, yeah, you don't have a sponsor. You need to get a sponsor. And so I got this guy, Ernie, over at Skyland to be my sponsor. Ernie Cook. I know some people here know Ernie. And I don't think Ernie's with us anymore, is he? No, he's not. And Ernie was my sponsor, although he never knew it. Now, I told people that Ernie was my sponsor, and there were other guys that I did that with. But I would go up to a guy like Ernie after the meeting. Ernie told a story at the Winter Circle one Saturday night, and I went over there and I said, "Hey, Ernie, I really like your story, man. Can I get your phone number? Will you be my sponsor?" And he goes, "Sure, young man, call me." And I said, "Sure, will." And never called him again, but told 100 people he's my sponsor. That's the kind of delusional shit that I do. So anyway, I come into AA. I love it. I really do love it. I got sober on the fellowship initially, guys. And I think that's what most of us do. Most of us come in here and we start to realize, hey, these people think like me. They act like me. They drink like me. They party like me. They get into trouble like me. You know what I'm saying? That's about as far as I could take it. But I liked them. They're crazy. They're zany. They're irreverent. They tell the best dirty jokes. The best stories. They like to stay up all night long and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and play pool and play spades. And, that was weird, man. That was like a spirit came out of me, you know. So I hung in with all these people, and it was great. And my first year sobriety went by like that. My second year sobriety went by like that. And then the third year, I started not doing so well. Now, I want to tell you something. On the outside, during this time, the outside of my life looked amazing. And it actually was amazing. It was better than it had ever been. Okay? I mean, I was always really overweight, drank so much, you know, just wild and out of control crazy. So I get sober. I start living a relatively sane and normal life. I start working full time. I get back into school. I wanted to be a scientist. Okay, that's what I wanted to be. I had always sort of entertained this idea of being a scientist. So I got back into school. I'm going to Kennesaw Community College or Kennesaw Junior College, whatever it was 30 years ago. Now it's like a big-ass university, but back then it was just like community college. You know, anybody in the community, as Chris Rock said, crack whores, you know, pimps. I mean, anybody could go, you know. So I'm going to community college. I'm working full time. I'm going to AA every single day. I mean, I went to 7 meetings a week my first 3 years without fail. It was just part of my thing. It was part of my routine. I love going. I love the people. I love the coffee. I love the cigarettes. Every meeting was a smoking meeting then. You know, I mean, I smoked 4 or 5 cigarettes every AA meeting, and so did everybody else. I mean, it was like you've been to nightclubs with less smoke than what we had in AA in those days. And so, but whatever, I'm rock and roll, I'm hanging out in AA, and on the outside, things are good. I got money in my pocket. My parents, who basically disowned me, now they love me. They're so proud. I cut my hair at some point, and they're like, oh, that's all they cared about. Like,
oh, he cut his hair, he must be sober.
You know, if I had known that, I'd have cut it a lot earlier and got back in their good, you know, in their good graces again. So, but I got a haircut, and so I'm like, and I'm working out, and I'm exercising, and I have a tan. You know, I love that Bill's story talks about that coat of tan on the well-to-do, you know. I kind of had that whole thing going. I got a new car. I came into some money. I had like this insurance settlement. And so in 1991, I was driving a 1991 model year car. And I really thought I had arrived when that happened, man. I mean, I'm driving the model year that I'm living in, which had never happened before. You know, I got a girlfriend. I got, you know, I did so well in junior college. I told you I'm smart. I could take your damn test. And I did so well in junior college, I transferred over to Emory now. Now I'm going to Emory. Now my parents really think, oh, my God, the kid has totally arrived. And so I'm going to Emory, and I'm a success story. And I got this car, and I got this killer guitar and this killer amplifier. And I got this great apartment in Midtown. And I got all this shit. I got all this junk and stuff out here. And I want to read a line of the big book that came to mean something big to me a little after this. Because this is really kind of the beginning of the end. Unconsciously, I think every one of us does this. I did it, and I still do it. I hope I have time to tell you a story about how I've done that with a lot of years of sobriety. I have this delusion that if I just get everything out here okay, if I get the girlfriend and the apartment and the car and the education and the job and the money in the bank account and all the toys, if I just get all these ducks lined up, that I'll be okay. I'll be happy. I don't think I really think beyond that. And I got it, guys. I got every bit of that. I had it all, and I was suicidally depressed and miserable. And there's a line in How It Works on page 61. And it says, is he not a victim, talking about the alcoholic, is he not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? And that's what I was doing. I was not turning my life over to the care of a higher power. I was not sponsored or even sponsorable. I was just self-willing it. I was just 100% self-will, twin engines, turbocharged, just go and get this and that and this and that and that. Just get up in the morning and go, 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 go. And overthinking everything and just, you know. And that's how I've been my whole life, just with a little different direction. So I don't really have, you know, they used to say in meetings, and I don't hear this much anymore, and I'm grateful I don't hear this, because I think it's terrible advice. They used to say, take what you want and leave the rest. You know, I don't hear that much anymore. I think it's good, because I'm an alcoholic. They said it's like a cafeteria line. Take what you want and leave the rest. If I go to the cafeteria line, I take 6 desserts, no meat, no bread, no potatoes, you know, and then I take the cash out of the register at the end of the line. Okay? That's what I take. All right? So don't take what you want and leave the rest. I mean, I finally got a sponsor about this time. I ran into a man who, actually, I didn't run into him. I'd seen him around. I didn't really like him. And I didn't like him because he was always carrying this book everywhere under his arm, you know, talking about amends and talking about sponsorship and talking about steps, talking about sponsoring guys and how great it was to be able to take a newcomer to a meeting, you know. And I was like, that doesn't sound very good, you know. I'm not going to come right out and say that. But on page 52, so anyway, I almost got drunk. Surprise. I almost got drunk. I did not, but I almost got drunk one night at a party that I had no business being at. I went to this party to prove I could go to it, basically, I think was what it was. Everyone was partying and getting loaded, and I was like, and I was so miserable. I was so suicidal, and I was so, my emotions were all over the place. My relationships were strained. You know, it's like I had 25 relationships in the first 3 years of sobriety, and every one of them was like I was in love with this girl, and I met her on the way to the coffee pot, and our eyes met, and I tell you, God put her there, And then, but it was always like somewhere between 2 and 8 weeks, these relationships. Like, I'm just like, love, she's the one, God put her there. To the, bam, you know, explosion. And then I've got the next one. I've always got the next kind of almost lined up. Like, I kind of know who the next one's going to be, because you never know when you're going to get dumped, and, you know, there's going to be an explosion. You got to move over here. So, always working those kinds of things. Anyway, so I'm going through all, this is where I'm at emotionally. And I pull this guy aside after meeting one night. He said something in the meeting that I related to. And I knew that he was sober a good while, longer than I was. And I told him, I said, hey, man, I almost got loaded this weekend, and I'm really miserable, and I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm suffering. I'm unhappy. And he goes, John, he goes, yeah, the big book. And I did not have a big book. So he did. So he said, I want to open this big book to page 52. And he said, I want you to read this. He says, this is describing the condition of untreated alcoholism, he said. That this is the way an alcoholic gets, someone who really has the illness of alcoholism, this is what they get like if they don't work the steps and they stay sober. He said, it always happens eventually. He says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. He said, does that describe how you're doing? And I said, man, sure as hell does. It describes, and he said, that's untreated alcoholism. He said, AA is a 12-step program. He said, have you worked all 12 steps? I said, nah. I was honest with you. I was beaten at this point. I was being honest finally. I was being sponsored even though I hadn't asked him to sponsor me yet. And it's really funny today looking back at this. To join a 12-step program and spend 2.5-3 years in that program and never work the 12 steps, it's got to be the height of insanity. You know, I'm a member of a 12-step organization. I don't do the 12 steps. You know, but I've since met hundreds of guys who have exactly the same experience. You know, so he said, look, are you willing to go through this? I'll go through this with you. And I said, yeah, I'd love that. And so we started meeting once a week and reading this book from page one. And went right through page 164, which is basically the meat and potatoes of the program. And it didn't take long. We started going to a big book study, too, and what was then my grand sponsor, who later became my sponsor's basement. And it was just like 50 guys in a basement drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, and listening to the Joe and Charlie. It was like big book workshop type tapes and stuff, and then reading the book up to the point, and then listening to the tape, and then reading the book. And then when we got to a prayer, we prayed that prayer. And when we got to a step, we did that step. And we came back, and we talked about it, and we, you know, started doing all this stuff. And it really started to become clear to me what this whole deal is, what this whole program is. You know, it says in our book that alcohol is the symptom. It doesn't even ever say stop drinking in our book. It's kind of, it doesn't even say that in step one. It says I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. See, that's the part that I missed out. When I start drinking, there's no control in it. Okay, that's how I drink. I drink hard and I drink fast and I drink more. And that's the way I like to drink. I don't want to drink it the other way. I don't want a pill ever that would make me able to drink like a normal person. Because what's the point of drinking like a normal person? You know, it's stupid. I don't want two beers. Two beers is a waste of time and money. But if I can't drink normally, then I'm doomed to always start drinking again. That's the hopeless nature of alcoholism, right? But the real deal is that when I'm not drinking, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, as it says in the doctor's opinion. I'm miserable when I'm not drinking. I know that I can't drink, but I'm miserable when I'm sober. And if I'm miserable sober long enough, it's my belief that I will just say screw it all and go back to doing it over and over and over again. I think that's what we do. My sponsor explained to me, John, the real problem is that your character's messed up. You got flawed character. You got character defects. You know, and we do inventory. The fourth and the fifth step are principled to do two things. To find the weak spots in my character. You know, for me, that's dishonesty. I told you I'm a phony, which is a form of dishonesty. It's self-centeredness. It's manipulation. It's judgment. I'm judgmental as hell. Everywhere I go, I think I know things about other people. You know, I'm saying, get on an elevator with you. I'm like, you think you're hot shit, don't you? I don't even know. I mean, not one word has come out of this guy's mouth. But I'm like, jerk. You know, all my life I've been that way. You know, so I got all these character defects. And I've also harmed people, hurt people, upset people, and operating on these character defects throughout my life. So the inventory puts our fingers on our weak spots in our inventory, And then step 6 and 7 is about me trying to, with God's help, get rid of those character defects. And 8 and 9 is with God's help trying to make it up to the people that I've harmed. You know, you pay back the money. You go look someone, you know. Matter of fact, I'll tell you a funny story. Actually, I'll come back to that funny story in a minute. So anyway, we started this process. And basically, my life took off from there. You know, I was basically 2.5 years sober. I'm ready to kill myself in sobriety or start drinking again. And 3 years sober, I'm totally transformed into a person who really understands this problem, really understands the nature of the solution, and has a willingness to put that solution into effect in his life. You know, and that was a big change for me. So anyway, that time, I just got busy in AA. You know, I'm a busy AA member. Okay, I hope that my feet demonstrate the busyness that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I don't look like someone who's saying one thing and doing another, because that's my MO my whole life. I sponsor a lot of guys. I have sponsored guys continuously since I was about 2.5 years, 3 years sober. I have been all over the world. I ended up, I wanted to be a scientist, I told you. I got an undergraduate degree from Emory in biology. I worked for a couple years in a laboratory as a lab assistant, you know, making like $19,000 a year just to see if I actually could do science. And then I applied to graduate school, got accepted, and went to Yale University graduate school and got a PhD in biology. And in the middle of that 7 year period, I actually relocated from Connecticut, where I was, you know, where Yale is, to London, England, with my wife and young baby, and we lived for 4 years in London, England. I got to have that whole experience, you know, which is a really bizarre thing about which I could talk for a couple of hours. I mean, it's really funny going to AA meetings in England, you know, hearing people, oh, well, you know, I drank it. It was sort of like, it was troublesome. It took some getting used to it. No offense to any English people in the room. It took some getting used to it. I'm sure they would come up, well, I drank like a crazy person in about some jail, you know. That's how they would talk about it. But came back here, had a total of 3 children, ended up working at Emory University for the last 20 years. As a scientist in the vaccine center over there, doing like amazing work that alcoholic junkie scumbags aren't supposed to do. Matter of fact, on my door, in my office door at Emory, it said John Shires, GED, PhD. Because everyone's got the little office door thing with the letters. You know, I'm like, you've got to put all my letters. You know, and I don't want GED up there, you know. It's a reminder, you know. And it's funny, though, because nobody ever said anything about that. No one ever said anything about that except for 2 foreigners. You know, 1 Pakistani guy and 1 Indian guy said something about it, but just because they didn't know what the letters meant. You know, like, oh, is that some special degree, John? You know, yeah, baby, special. But I think everybody else, like all the like normal American types, were all just too embarrassed to ask. Hey, I don't want to know what's going on there. You know, GED, PhD. But that's just thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, every good thing I got in my life is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I told you, I had this 25 or 30 really short-term, dramatic, painful relationships, you know, my first 3 years in it. You know, 25, totally insane, like just blah, you know. And then I worked the 12 steps, and since I worked the 12 steps, 2 relationships I have had. One was for 1.5 years, and one's been for 25 years. And if any of y'all were here last Monday, my wife Kathy was the speaker last Monday. I told her, I get to do the rebuttal, baby. You know, so be careful what you say. But that's, thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a guy who can do that. On my own power, which is what I'm hardwired to follow, my own power, I always screw everything up. But I'm obsessed with managing it all myself. So I'm stuck in this trap that I can't spring of, I know I'm not going to be able to do this on my own power, but I have to do it on my own power. Which makes me unsponsorable. It makes me unteachable. It traps me in a The third step prayer has a beautiful line in it. It says, relieve me of the bondage of self. That's the bondage of self. You know, and that's why self-centeredness and selfishness is the root of the alcoholic problem. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I am not in bondage to self anymore. I can care about people, and I can be a husband and a son and a brother and a friend and a home group member and a co-worker, and I can do all these things that I could never ever do. All that stuff was impossible for me. You know, I mean, the tension that builds up in my life with when I have untreated alcoholism is too much, and I got to drink. You know, so I have a disease that demands to be treated. I'm either going to treat it with the 12 steps, or I'm going to treat it with alcohol and drugs. And there's no two ways about it. Eventually, I'm going to treat it with one of those two things. And thank God, I'm one of the lucky ones. Because I know in this program, a lot of people have picked up with 2 or 5 or 10 years. If you ever go to AA convention, like the Atlanta Roundup, or whatever, they always do these sobriety countdowns, usually on Saturday night, you know, before the big speaker. And if you watch, you know, so basically, okay, everyone stand up now. Okay, sit down if you have less than a year. Okay, then sit down if you have less than 2 years. Sit down if you have less than 3 years. And you have like 2,000 people standing up to start with. And then there's not very many people left standing up by 5 years. And by the time you get to 10 years, there's, I mean, almost nobody, like 1% of the room still standing up. Something happens in here between 1 year and 10 years. It always happens to a true alcoholic that they need relief. And I needed relief. And I was one of the lucky ones because I ran into a guy who had done all 12 steps, who was armed with the facts about himself, and could win my confidence enough to make me believe maybe I can do this too. So thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you guys for listening. I appreciate it.
Somebody cussed you out.
I guess it's fine. Is it okay?
Okay.
I'm going to steal the line that you gave right before you started tonight. See, you said you couldn't control the message, but you could control the light show.
Light show.
Beautiful jacket. I'll say that you controlled the message damn good tonight. I might not be the only one that's not going to drink tonight. Thank you, John.
Bring your checkbook, baby, let me hold the door. We'll go and get my guitar. I can't wait for you no more.